And that does then lead on to the next session in relation to some of the things that we are doing out in the wide world, if you like, our secondary objective around communications. And as I said yesterday, I'm delighted that Lothar and Vincent have agreed to talk about what they're doing in relation to their organisations or representative bodies in terms of communication. So I'm not sure if you have agreed between you or Aida has told you which order you're doing it, and it looks as though it is because it's Vincent first. So Vincent, I'll leave it to you.
I would like to express my thanks, Joanna, and also express my thanks to Aida and to the council members for this opportunity to highlight the contribution and participation of CFA Institute, which is the organization I do represent, as far as what we are doing to contribute to IFRS development and education. From my discussion with Aida, she mentioned that that should really be the scope of this type of update that I'm going to give. But that being said, I think it's important to also highlight why we do the work that we do. So I'll also give a very brief historical profile and also really highlight and delineate the global profile of organization. Another component of my comments would be around the work that CFA Institute is doing around the whole question of investor protection. So the various strands to that piece of work, and being involved in accounting standards and auditing standards is just one component of that. Then I'll come to the meat of what this session is meant to be about, to showcase specific examples of how we've contributed and collaborated with the ISB as far as reaching out to our members who are investors. So the next slide, which shows some profile of organization, which has existed in its current form since 2004. But the history dates far back to 1947, when there was a collaboration of financial analysts who were seeking to have greater professionalization of the industry, really thinking that it's necessary to enhance both the competence and character of investor professionals. The organization crystallized in 1963 when we began offering the exam. And at the time, we had about 250 candidates who took the exam, but that's grown significantly over time. The latest version of the exam in 2015, we've got up to 180,000 candidates taking the exam, and it's much more a global body than it was at its roots when it was founded in the US. I also have a slide which has some headlines stats on our global profile, showing clearly we've got a footprint that spans across the world. In the stats that I've got here, there's one restatement that I need to make. I've said we've got 300,000 candidates. It's actually much less than that. It's 180,000. But that's grown significantly from 16,000 way back in 1990. And at this point in time, we've got 135,000 members across 150 countries. We also have what we call societies, which are in many cases country chapters, country communities, which enable us to more effectively engage with our members. So for example, here in the UK, we do have the CFA UK, which is actually very actively engaged with the ISB as well. But that's almost on an autonomous basis in comparison to the broader organization. But this is very important structure that we've got in place to help us reach out to members who are spread out in many jurisdictions. We offer the exam, and in the exam, a core component of what we educate our members and candidates on is on IFRS. So this financial statement analysis. And at this point in time, there's a predominant focus on educating investors on IFRS. So that's one key way in which you're contributing to knowledge and awareness and spreading the skill sets that investors need to have as far as IFRS application is concerned. So that's candidates who take the exam, they become members. When they're members, we're also involved in their lifelong learning needs. But beyond that, we need to give some attention to the ecosystem within which they operate. So in that respect, we're also integrally involved in work that relates to investor protection. So the various areas which we address, including financial reporting and auditing policy, this capital markets policy, which addresses issues, for instance, around corporate governance, share owner rights, the regulation that's being enacted in Brussels around MiFID being an example, what's occurred in the US around Dodd-Frank. We pay close attention to those type of issues that are rolled out and have implications for investors. We are also a global standard setter for the investment professionals, in as we've got guidelines that guide how the asset management firms ought to measure performance. So in that respect, we also put on the standard setter hat, and we've got an understanding of the business model that the standard setter tends to operate by. We've got a code of conduct which we roll out to the asset management firms as well. But just homing in on what would be of interest to this particular audience, which would really be around the accounting standards and auditing, the various strands to our involvement. So we've been quite integrally involved in IFRS and US GAAP development. And this has spanned over many decades. In the recent past, we've been quite at the core of the developments that have been occurring on the convergence, the financial crisis-related responses. We've had policy publications on a lot of the key topics where we aim to put out aspirational and what we deem to be thought leadership positions. So for example, we've had publications around key topics such as the comprehensive income disclosure, private company reporting. Those are just some examples of where we've issued what we deem to be thought leadership publications. Seats at the table, we've got representation at the IFRIC, we've participated at the CMAC Advisory Council. I'm participating in this particular iteration of the Advisory Council, but in the past we've sponsored candidates to participate representing CFA Institute. So for those of you who may have observed these sessions in the past, we had the likes of Robert Morgan and Dane Mott, who are representing CFA Institute in the Advisory Council.
You also have a trustee.
Oh, yes. we do have, actually, the managing director who oversees our standards and advocacy division. He's also been appointed as a trustee of the IFRS Foundation. And he has other roles as well with the SEC and the PCAOB. On the auditing side, we've got lots of touch points with the IAASB, the PCAOB, SEC, ESMA, EFRAG, the Financial Reporting Council. Just one example of this is on the IAASB consultative advisory group, where the current chair is from the CFA Institute. I know some of the council members are part of that group. I believe, is it Vania? You're part of that group. So we've got representation there. But beyond being involved in the rollout of standards, we also take part in member outreach and education, conducting member surveys, and also facilitating investor engagement as and when required. Increasingly in the recent past, we're also giving some attention to building strategic partnerships and undertaking other stakeholders' engagement. So for instance, what was presented to us by the Federation of European Accountants, the discussion paper, we'll be intending to have an outreach event to help put out the ideas that they've got out there and to elicit responses from investors. But this stakeholder outreach also extends to the audit firms, in some cases to the media and other interested parties. So that's just the backdrop of the various work we do as far as actual accounting standards are concerned. And I've got some slides which give specific examples of where CFA Institute has taken a very clear position, notably the LISA standard, where we had a comment letter in 1971, which was calling for they need to put the leases on balance sheet.
That's so, even further back than exactly. I said with my 15 years.
So indeed, we've got a long history. Though I must not, I'm not the author of that comment letter. I wasn't around then. Well, we have also had some flagship publications. One particular one that's worth highlighting is the Comprehensive Business Reporting Model, which was quite a provocative piece, which was meant to stimulate debate. And there's quite some varied reaction to this particular publication. Many consider it to be several of its proposals, for instance, around fair value accounting and the cash flow statement. There's a proposal to have the direct cash flow statement. Many considered some of the proposals to have been too aspirational. But nevertheless, these ideas have been a necessary yardstick of thinking about what investors want. And it was encouraging to note that in one of the introspective or review sessions that one of the board members, Paul Pachter, was undertaking in 2011, the year 2011, he was actually making reference to this particular publication and the principles that had been delineated and measuring the progress that had been accomplished through IFRS development based on the proposals that had been put forward in this particular publication. Another publication we had in the past was produced in 1993, Financial Reporting in the 1990s and Beyond. It's also worth mentioning that one of the board members, Pat McConnell, ex-board members Pat McConnell, was integrally involved in the development of these particular publications. And that also contributed to her reputation and profile as an investor representative. Now, getting to the specific examples, or rather to showcase how we've collaborated with the IFRS Foundation, I just have a few examples here. In the last 2 or 3 years, we've done quite some work on investor education. So we've produced both video and audio webcasts, which aim to reach out to investors on both completed standards or newly rolled out standards, just really outlining and delineating the impacts for financial analysis of these standards. They tend to vary in length, like the webcasts, the video webcasts have been about 10 to 20 minutes. The audio webcasts have been, in many cases, much longer, about an hour or so. But they tend to be quite well attended, and it's a very effective instrument of reaching out to our members. Another example that's worth highlighting is an event that we recently co-hosted with the IFRS Foundation. This was on the anniversary of the Investors in Financial Reporting Program. So in January, we had this event here in London, and we had quite a good turnout of institutional investors. And I think both from the point of view of the IFRS and from our point of view, it was a fairly successful event. I think if we have more opportunities to host similar events, it's certainly worth having the conversation. I've mentioned that we do facilitate member access, and we've done so in respect of the IFRS agenda consultation. So whenever the IFRS Foundation is endeavoring to reach out to a broader pool of investors, we've been able to facilitate that request or that desire to reach out to a broader pool of investors. I did mention that we've got this global footprint of country chapters, and the IFRS Foundation has often had the desire to reach out to particular jurisdictions. And one example where we've successfully collaborated is in respect of the French Society. And we are having some discussions as to how we could extend this process to our other societies so that the ISB can talk to more investors on the ground. And then the last example I'll just mention is in respect of the IFRS Education Initiative. We had one of our managing directors, Tom Robinson, who in the past, when he was with us, was involved with the Education Advisory Group. So these are just some examples which hopefully showcase how we are collaborating and hope to continue collaborating with the IFRS Foundation. Thank you.
Vincent, I think that that is a really great example of, if you like, what our secondary objective is, and you demonstrating and through CFA as to what we're doing, what you're doing in terms of, you know, assisting and working with the foundation in terms of promoting the standards. So thank you very much for sharing that with us, and I hope that others can think of, well, what can we do in a similar fashion? Of course, we're all different organisations. But perhaps, are there any questions of Vincent in terms of his presentation or the kind of things that they are doing? Tom.
Thank you. Thank you for this very good presentation. I was wondering, when I look to slide number 5, you refer to both IFRS and US GAAP. And I see a lot of cooperation with the foundation, with the IFRS. What is the cooperation with the FASB?
One benefit of our organization is that we are global. So one aspiration we do have actually is to be nonpartisan. So what's interesting is we get the sense that Convergence has, not the sense, it's clear that Convergence has come to the end of the road, but we feel it's important to encourage both boards to keep working together. So in that respect, we also aim to, at least we have mechanisms where we keep collaborating with the FASB as well. We do respond to their comment letters or to the issues that they put out for investor input. And also that gives us the vantage point where we can, in a sense, Hugh mentioned that the staff members are talking to each other, but also from a constituent standpoint, we are also a lot more attuned to where both boards need to be perhaps more closely aligned. I just give one example. I know the FASB is currently addressing the cash flow statement. So and that's an important area for users of financial statements. So when it comes to the performance reporting project, we'll also be keeping tabs on what the IFRS Foundation would be doing in that respect.
Any other questions of Vincent? Again, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Now, Lota, and have you got somebody?
Hillary.
Yes. Welcome, Hillary.
Am I free to go? Okay, absolutely. Thank you. Yes, as you already mentioned, there's somebody else here, Hilary Eastman. She's from PwC, and the reason why she's here is that the CRUF organization is not really an organization, it's just a group of people interested in the subject, and PwC actually provides some organizational backup and even facilities, so we're very thankful that we have them, otherwise it wouldn't work. And that's why it's right that Hillary would also be here and has supported me already. We have some of our advertising material which went around, and we haven't printed the slides. I didn't think that they are so useful, but anybody who does want the slides can, of course, just send me a mail and can have it sent. And there are also some somewhat cluttered slides in the course of the presentation, which refer to documents of CRUF. All these documents are on the CRUF site. You know, they're not necessarily discernible here. Okay, so what's the CRUF? It's the corporate reporting users forum, which I'm representing here. It's a much smaller and less known organization, obviously, than CFA Institute. And to some degree, it was founded in 2005 and is now, is still expanding. It's in 11 countries and has over 250 members. And but it's an informal network. It's not a lobby organization or anything like this. It's a network of users, which are analysts, which are investment managers. Like the majority tends to be analysts, and like over 50%, and then fund managers and some other functions in asset management companies. In the statement here, the second statement, it says it's a network where people come together who otherwise wouldn't have time to dig into the substance or the accounting reporting issue. That may sound a little bit odd at first, but it really reflects a fundamental issue, which is that there are very few people in the investment community who are actually fully committed or designated to deal with accounting or reporting issues. Anything that's done here, most of it by far, is done by people who are just doing it in addition to their daily job in the bank or in the asset management company. So that's also one reason why you have trouble in general to get the user side to engage in a kind of organized way. So that's what we're trying to do, despite all this, to still have some discussion and some idea of what we need, and try to present that and convey that to the standard setters and regulators. Now, and one thing I hadn't said yet, it's equities, but it's also corporate bonds. It's buy side, it's sell side. Within the user community and the investment community, we're pretty much diversified. But it's always the individual that participates, and we have hardly anybody who's sent from their company. And like, for instance, just as an example, I had 50 analysts in my department. There was one guy who was allowed to spend some time on these issues, and that's not because I didn't think it was important, but I couldn't really justify versus the board and even versus my sales units to have somebody doing this, because they wouldn't understand it, you know, to spend resources on that, just as an example. Now, right, so it's a discussion forum, very loosely organized, but we do have some guiding principles. This is something you may not be able to fully read, but it's, like I say, on the website. And some things I would like to take out of this. The one thing is, we do agree with the principles-based approach to standards. That's one of the first principles we also have. One thing it also says, it's we look for financial or corporate reporting to the financially literate. So, you know, it's not sometimes the discussion goes a little bit that things have to be easily understandable and so on. Yes, everything has to be clear and well presented, but not in layman terms. You know, you don't have to avoid complicated words or anything. It's for the financial literate, although obviously users tend not to be accountants, but they deal with financial numbers all the time. And another thing in the guiding principles, we don't want companies to be restricted in what they report. And I think it was yesterday, something came up, I don't know if Hans said it, that to push back on non-GAAP reporting. I'm getting a little bit sensitive when I hear that. I don't think anybody, or like, no, very few people would want to have a pushback on non-GAAP reporting. Maybe some guidelines on consistency, on reconciliation with GAAP figures, but non-GAAP reporting is as important, much, sometimes even more than the GAAP reporting, and it's a flexible and changing element where either the analysts or the investors come up with things, key numbers they want to report it, or the industries. So that's something we always like to get everything out of the company that they think is important. So that we have in the guiding principles. What else? Yeah, next section here is that we say the economic substance is always more important than the form, and that really relates to an issue which I guess every investor and analyst has, that let's say the danger that management misrepresents the economic situation of the company, especially of course if there's negative developments. That's something which we have out of experience, and it may be a minority, but that's always a risk. So it's always the economic substance, obviously, we're looking at in the reporting. And when you look at the different, there are statements to the main financial statements. One thing which is very important, analysts make models, right? And in my unit, we had a model which combined the balance sheet, the P&L, and the cash flow statement, and they had to interlink without any residuals. And the analysts were really struggling to get that done based on company information and even talking to company management and being specialized on industries. So there's still, let's say, sorry, there's still work to be done in that respect, that everything really links into each other and that, that it's reported in such a way. Okay, guiding principles. The organization, I already said, it's now 11 countries. In Europe, we have Germany, France, and the UK. But we have regular calls of all the country units together, when also people from Sweden or Switzerland or Spain can come in who don't have their own country group. That's something which we started relatively new, and that's really a good development. Like I said, it's a growing number of people, and India has just joined. In addition to the local units, we have sector specialist groups which go across the whole world. We have insurance and banking, because you know most analysts who are not specialized in that don't understand the balance sheets of banks or insurance companies. We had leasing and revenue recognition when that was a topic to be dealt with, and we're thinking about new groups like technology and technology in the sense of reporting technology, what we were discussing this time too, and integrated reporting. So issues which are coming to prominence in the discussion, we try to also then organize in our CRUF organization. Right. What am I doing? Right, it was. Thank you. So I was doing before. Okay. Right. So, and we are communicating our views. Again, it's not views of the whole group. It's a discussion group. So there's hardly ever any complete consensus. But you know, there are common views on basic things. So we have discussions with the standard setters and the regulators. We send comment letters. We talk in conferences. There's press coverage. We have the website, and we coordinate to some degree globally, but you know, not very intensively. Now, in the group meeting, either on the country level or also especially on the European level, like when there are several countries together, we almost every time have somebody joining in, be it the ISB, be it ESMA, be it somebody else, to actually probe views of the users or to present new ideas. That's always a very important part of our discussions. Then, of course, Krupp representative on the Advisory Council, that's me, but I'm not the only one I'm representing Krupp, but Goro, for instance, is also a Krupp member in Japan. And I don't think there's anybody else, or no. But, you know, Goro is also there. And the meetings are, again, different by country. Japan is meeting every month. Germany is meeting like more every 2-3 months. Depends on how many members there are in each country and what is current to discuss. And in order to coordinate, we also send the agenda of the Advisory Council meeting to the global Krupps to get any feedback from the different regions if they have specific issues. Sorry. Now, we are writing comment letters and, you know, just see the last few years. And I highlighted one comment letter, which was just recently on this issue, came out recently on the issue of insurers applying IFRS 9 or being exempted for a while. That's a relatively controversial one. It goes to EFRAG. And it says that we don't like that at all and refers to several other people who have already, out of Krupp, who have already made that presentation. And this is one example where, even though we're not discussing things in one big group, I guess almost everybody agrees that we don't like different applications of different standards according to different circumstances. Now, if the application of a standard leads to volatility in the results, in earnings or revenue, whatever, that's not so bad. If you have, like for users, for analysts and investors, if you have a clear, consistent generation of the underlying numbers, and you know what this volatility is coming from, then you can see what's going on. It's not a purpose in itself to smooth earnings. What analysts do, obviously, is to try to adjust for temporary factors and so on, but that we can do ourselves. You know, we need the underlying information. So if you get to smoothing by not consistently applying the principles, that's much worse than having fluctuations in the numbers themselves, in the reported numbers. Okay, this is now the last one, and again, you don't have to read it, but the document is, you cannot even read it, no? The document is on the website. I just replicated it here. This is in 2011, we decided to figure out what can we propose in terms of actionable points where the ISB could hopefully do something, which are points which we think have to be addressed. The first thing is segmental reporting. We want detail in the segments, ideally as much as in the overall report, and we want everything to be able to be reconciled to the main statements. That's always a key point. On debt or net debt reconciliation, we really want to be able to match one-to-one the net debt situation at the end of one period to the beginning or to the end of the next period, which isn't so easily possible because you have from currency effects to takeovers, whatever, you have all kinds of effects which are not clearly stated and which are not very transparent. To get you from the net debt to the next. And of course, we need a net debt definition, not necessarily overall, but by each company which is reporting. And we had actually some progress in this direction with the adjustment to IS-7 just recently. So that's good, that's a step forward. The other thing is debt as such, the structure of the debt of a company, maturity structure, of course, but also things like to what degree, what covenants are applicable to the debt, just as an example. And here, the materiality aspect comes in again. Obviously, you don't want a huge report on the covenants of each loan that the company is holding, or each bond, or has issued, but you want to have a clear statement for the major critical parts which are relevant and material. Next thing is the structure of cash. In a similar way, we'd like to know if the company is reporting cash holdings, are they really available, or are they in some areas where you have foreign exchange restrictions, or do you get taxed if you, like in the US, if you repatriate cash? Those are all bits of information which are relevant to really look at how do I assess the future development and the value of the valuation of the company. And last thing is mergers and acquisitions. Again, something where a lot of things are not very clear. Where you have, firstly, it starts, of course, with getting a full picture of what has been paid for a company or for a unit that is bought, but also how did I value the intangibles, for instance, really exactly state how did I get to the value of the patents, the customer lists, whatever. To get a clear picture of what management actually paid for what, and then get some idea of how this actually played out or is playing out once the takeover has taken place. I mean, this is very often a huge factor, and a factor which is very hard to assess for for an investor or an analyst. So just to give an example, those were issues which are discussed in this CRUF organization. Don't expect, coordinated view, but we're trying to present, general interest and things which are important to us into the relevant bodies, and PwC is helping us in that.
We try.
Yeah. That's what I want to say. Anything else one should say from your side? Hillary?
No, I think you covered everything about CRUF. I think the great thing about CRUF, and we're really proud to support it, because over the last 11 years now, it's grown into something that, we arrange meetings for them with the IASB and others pretty much every time they meet around the world. And we have a great dialogue with the IASB staff, Barbara and her team, trying to arrange meetings between users and CRUF participants about a variety of topics that are ongoing. We're also working to help the CRUF get involved in more broader reporting issues. So this discussion we've had today has been quite informative for that. And in fact, we've heard a lot of users say they want more information about ESG, more about auditor reporting. So a variety of issues that beyond just the accounting standard setting that they've been really, really interested in. And so we're trying to help them partly be educated about it and partly present their view to the world about what they think about those issues. So it's been really great to be able to support CRUF over the years.
Thank you, Lota, and I've immediately forgotten your name.
Hillary.
I apologize. I thought Hillary, and I thought no. For that, and again, another demonstration where one of our members is obviously engaging widely in relation to the IFRS standards. So thank you to both of you. I think that this session that we're now having on a regular basis in terms of member communications is playing out well in terms of understanding and helping us for the future, and that we already do have volunteers for presenting at the next meeting, which is really good. And Anne, I see you have your flag up and obviously want to make a comment. So before I wrap up.
It's in fact a short question to both to Vincent and Lothar. I see that your organizations are both involved in writing comment letters. So who is writing the comment letters? Do you apply to volunteers in your organization? What kind of system do you have to make people participate in this comment letter writing?
Okay, I'll start. It's a difficult task, especially in an organization where you don't have anybody, working hired for the organization. So what we do is whenever issues come up, somebody volunteers, and again, PwC sometimes helps and spreads out the question. Somebody volunteers and makes a draft, and then it goes around, and everybody who thinks it's there's some other issues which have to be highlighted or something's wrong would write a comment into that, and in the end we get a comment letter which then everybody who agrees signs. So it's not that everybody automatically has to sign, but the people who say, yeah, this is what we want to convey, they sign.
If I could add to that, there are some, I guess, practical challenges that CRUF faces in that there are a lot of companies, some banks, for example, or ratings agencies that will not let their people sign a letter. So even though they've been part of the discussion and have contributed to the meeting and may agree with what's in the comment letter, their name will not appear on it. So whoever's listed on a CRUF comment letter, those are the people whose companies allow them to sign in a personal capacity. But there are some behind the scenes who may agree with it that just haven't been able to sign. Mm.
From our end, we do have a working group. It's called the Corporate Disclosure Policy Council. It's principally comprised of investment professionals, but there are also some accounting specialists within that group. So they've got a key responsibility in helping formulate our position. But we also do, from time to time, reach out to our members on specific issues. So, for example, on the impairments standard that we had on leases, we did reach out to our members to find out where they do stand. Then we incorporate that into our comment letters, and then we've got a whole review and governance oversight mainly based on that particular Corporate Disclosure Policy Council, and that's really the basis which we put forward our letters.
Good question, Anne, because it's that's a key part of our communicating, and how do you actually get it to happen? Ton, and I'm going to say that is going to be the last one, please. Oh, Goro, okay.
Thank you.
I know
very
some
much.
People are going to have to go, that's all.
I went to the website of CRUF, and there is a paper with the 5 quick wins, but then I saw a year, 2011. And I was wondering, we are 5 years further, and so there is not that much progress, I'm afraid, or do I misunderstand?
Well, compared to a 1971 letter on leases.
Sorry, what's happening here? I was wondering, how could CRUF increase their effectiveness in this area, because I think it are really important issues you bring up, and if it are only quick wins.
Yeah, we called them quick wins because we thought those were things which are relatively easy. I mean, easier than a completely new definition of revenue recognition or something like this. And we have had the first little success. I don't think we're not unhappy, because we have a regular exchange with, the standard setter regulators and so on. And there's also a question of how much can we handle, because everybody is pitching in, but not really full time. Yeah, I guess growing the network and like this European combined discussion, which then brings an even broader part of the user society to in front of the regulator and so on. Those are steps we're trying to do, but I don't see any, let's say, I don't have any idea of any huge improvement of that.
Goro?
Okay, that the just to add something to the Lothar and the Hilary, but the, before the, you know, introducing that the Japan Craft activity, regarding Five Quick Win, I think that the ISB's recent, you know, amendment to IFR 7, cash flow. And, you know, I think that this is, you know, I believe that the motivation to ISB to amend this one is that one of the Craft Five Quick Win regarding net debt reconciliation. And I think that this is a major achievement among that this Five Quick Win. And also that I'd like to briefly introduce the Japan Crafts activities. We meet every month, the day of 15, and we set agenda, and mostly that the new ISB's exposure draft. And one of the members volunteered to be a chair ad hocly, and the chairman of that meeting will draft that, you know, our comment letter from Japan to Global Craft. And I tend to be the translator of these comments. Okay, but I think that one of the Japan Craft is one of the most actively meeting group. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Garo.
I can confirm that the Japanese comment letters are always the most specific and detailed ones that we get.
Okay, you can have a group hug afterwards. Okay, thank you very much to Vincent and Lothar and Hilary for that. Again, very, very useful, and we will continue these member communication sessions.